Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. On today's show, Monocle contributor Mary Pletier reports on the state of design in Israel. First up,
what was right, then wrong, became right again, in the sense of people crave clothes which will last a lifetime, which have this very classic, simple design.
We visit a company giving the nation's early fashion a modern twist. Next.
In Tel Aviv, the traditional and the contextual is about freedom. I'm really trying to find a way to be in context in Tel Aviv.
An architect's perspective on Israel's shifting built environment. We'll also visit the school regarded as the birthplace of Israeli design and meet a young designer innovating with floral fashion accessories. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Without further ado, here's Mary.
Israel is a young country with countless identities. At only 69 years old, it sits between the eastern edge of the Mediterranean and the Middle East, its population a heady mix of Jews, Arabs, and Christians. Over 2,000 years of Holy Land history weighed heavily on the newly established Jewish state in the years following 1948. Middle Eastern heritage and European influences began to mix in the new cultural landscape. Today, Israel is a place where the very old meets the very new. Museums filled with antiquities and innovative tech startups both have a place here. So do Tel Aviv beach holidays and ancient pilgrimage routes. But what do these identity politics mean for Israel's contemporary designers, artists, and makers? How do they navigate the country's historical grab bag of influences, which range from Byzantine to Bauhaus, and try to come up with something identifiably Israeli? It can be confusing terrain for those working in a country so young. To find out a bit more about the aesthetics of Israel's earliest years, I headed to Tel Aviv, where the country's founding fashion is having a renaissance. Before the State of Israel even existed, new Jewish immigrants already had a defining style, and that style was Atta, spelled A-T-A. Atta was Israel's first textile and clothing company, established in 1934. Their no-nonsense trousers and boxy button-down shirts became the pioneering Israeli uniform. In the austerity years of building a new country, everyone wore Atta, even the prime minister. Bankrupted in the 1980s, the only Atta available for the past 30 years had to be hand-me-downs. But today, on one of the busiest corners of Tel Aviv's Rothschild Boulevard, Atta is back in business.
Atta was never about fashion. It was about clothing. Atta was an historical textile factory which was established in the north of Israel for two reasons. One, to supply work for the new Jewish immigrants in Israel, and two, to create clothes for the new Jewish immigrants to Israel.
That's Shahar Sigal, the Israeli businessman behind the rebirth of the Atta clothing line. Dressed in a soft gray Atta tee, topped off with the brand's unbuttoned casual red and white striped shirt, he's at home in his new shop, the second Atta store to open in Tel Aviv in the past year. He's surrounded by casual clothes in bold primary colors. They're trendy in an understated way, billowy shirts with boxy lines and comfortable trousers in cotton fabrics.
What was right, then wrong, became right again, in the sense of, I think people crave to buy clothes which will last a lifetime, which they can wear forever, which they can give to their kids, which have this very classic, simple design with a very high quality of manufacturing and cloth.
Shahar teamed up with veteran Israeli stylist and designer Yael Schenberger to revive the brand, something that, in the face of a booming fast fashion economy, wouldn't be easy. But Atta has the nostalgia factor. Its blue and white triangle logo is iconic throughout the country. For young Israelis, it reminds them of the clothes their grandparents wore. Yael scoured the country for vintage pieces.
Most of my research was physical research, to look for the clothes and to learn from the clothes. First of all, I spread the rumor that I'm looking for Atta clothing, and it helped a lot. Accidentally, also, I found a shop in Petah Tikva. It was as if you got back on time, exactly like Atta shop used to be. A full shop. I called Shachar. Shachar said, buy it all.
In Israel's early years, the government handed out clothing ration cards to be used in Atta's shops. They produced clothes that could withstand working the land on the country's new kibbutzes, school uniforms for children, and weekend clothes as well. It was a literal one-stop shop for the entire country's wardrobe, even Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion.
First of all, I took the Olim Chadashim package, the blue shirt, the white shirt, the Shabbat shirt, the blue pants, and the kova tembel, and the hat. And I took these pieces and I tried to understand why they look the way they looked. It looked simple at the beginning. All the shapes originally came from uniform, school uniform, army uniform, are comfortable in a very unique way.
So how do you make an anti-fashion icon fashionable again? Yael stuck to the basics. The Shabbat shirt and blue pants are near replicas. But she also began working with new fabrics, adding pockets and adjusting necklines, trying out classic designs in floral or checked prints.
They were growing the cotton, weaving the fabrics, dyeing the fabric. You won't be able to wear it because it's uncomfortable in a way that we are too spoiled to wear it now, you know? This is what we call Ben-Gurion shirts. So the fact that I made it from another material, it's updating.
It changes it.
It totally changes. Mm-hmm. Whenever you change the material, the garment looks different than it used to.
Each new Atta piece is made in Israel. The company is one of the few textile manufacturers working in the country's increasingly high-tech landscape. Though their small new shop is divided into men's and women's looks, young Tel Avivians mix and match the styles, which are effectively unisex. It's a characteristic pulled from the country's earliest design ethos. Keep it simple.
There is a design, an Israeli look. What is it? Very difficult to define in words. But I think when, as an Israeli, and Yael as an Israeli designer, I can identify it. I can look at it and say, yes, I know this is something originated here. It smells, it looks, it feels local.
That was Shachar Segal speaking to me from his newest Atta shop in Tel Aviv, with a little help from his chief designer, Yael Schenberger. Emerging out of the Atta shop onto the tree-lined, bike-friendly Rothschild Boulevard, it's easy to see how their back-to-basics local apparel fits with Tel Aviv's breezy atmosphere. It's also easy to see how this aesthetic translates to the city's famed international-style architecture. So I strolled up the boulevard and into the heart of Tel Aviv's White City to meet up with Israeli architect Alan Ben-Nun. Tel Aviv was an established city long before Israel was founded. Today, it's the country's architectural crown jewel. Originally, it was planned as a garden city by British authorities in Mandate Palestine in the mid-1920s. But in the 1930s and 40s, as Jewish architects fled the rise of the Nazi regime in Europe, they arrived on the shores of Tel Aviv, bringing with them the building blocks of modernism.
Tel Aviv was founded in 1909. For the first 20-something years, it was not the White City. Most of the buildings in Tel Aviv were built in Eastern European style, that we call now eclectic style. And in the 1930s, when the international style, the international style started at the 20s, but in the 1930s, it arrived here with architects coming back from Europe. People studied in the Bauhaus, but also worked for Le Corbusier, then they became very influential architects in Israel.
Alan Ben-Nun navigates Tel Aviv's architectural history every day. His office is a lively open-plan space just off Rothschild Boulevard, and he likes to make sure his projects are within cycling distance. Most of them are dotted around the heart of the White City, which extends from his office up through the northern end of Tel Aviv. It seems like every street off the Central Boulevard is a study in modernism, rendered in all white. The Rubinsky House on Schenken Street is made of long, curved terraces stacked tightly on top of one another. Nearby, the thermometer house on Frug Street features diagonal window slats running thinly up the length of its four stories. Alon's projects, whether completely new residences or the restoration of a 1930s property, revolve around enhancing the omnipresent international style, updating properties for contemporary life. Adding levels, adding entryways, restoring balconies all have a place in his practice. But at the same time, he is working on brand new Tel Aviv residences that echo but don't copy what's already there.
The idea is really working with shapes and colors and volumes that Tel Aviv is built upon.
So it doesn't just have to be a white box.
It is a white box, but the white box... there's a lot of nuances to the white box. You know, there's a lot of shades of black, and there's a lot of many shades of white. There are a lot of boxes, and you can work a lot with a box.
It's true. The international-style buildings that fill up Tel Aviv's streets are as unique to each other as they are to examples of 20th-century modernism around the world. Just as Alon is updating 1930s style to fit contemporary needs, the original European architects had to adapt their Bauhaus-trained minds to a totally new climate.
In Europe, the international style was all about big windows. And in Israel, you cannot have big windows.
Too hot?
It's too hot, and the radiation is high, and you need a lot of shade. So they changed the idea of the strip window into the strip terrace. So you see a lot of terraces in Tel Aviv. And also because of the hot weather, the terraces in summer, no air condition to be found at the time, you had to have terrace just to escape the heat of the evening.
The White City is a UNESCO World Heritage Site with around 4,000 international-style buildings on its roster, and many of them are now around 90 years old. It takes time, experience, and proper white plaster to restore these buildings and also get them up to code. Bauhaus designers didn't have to worry about the height of their windowsills, but today, that sort of minor detail is just one of the many things the municipality needs to regulate.
You don't need to go through special training. You don't need to have a special diploma.
White city diploma.
Yeah, you don't need that. But with time, you get to a point where the working with the municipality, which is heavily regulated and regulating the preservation buildings, they start trust you and you get to know them and you know how to work with that. And so it is a special process.
It takes a special architect to work within the preservational confines of the White City. Alon, who enjoys the challenge, is finishing up the restoration of a U-shaped building just off Dizengoff Street, where he has added two floors made up of exposed concrete above the original white plaster building. Top that off with a lift and the combination of three separate stairwells into one central entrance, and the restoration project has taken him 10 years.
In Tel Aviv, the traditional and the historical and the contextual is about freedom, openness, new ideas, avant-garde. I'm really trying to find a way to be in context in Tel Aviv.
That was Alon Ben-Nun speaking to me from his architecture studio in the heart of Tel Aviv's White City.
Still to come on the show, we pay a visit to the country's Bezalel Academy of Art and a young designer giving boutonnieres a boost.
Monaco has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In New York City, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
You really can be anyone you want to be in New York. You can dress exactly how you like. You can act exactly how you like. There's that tolerance and acceptance that I think perhaps doesn't exist quite like it does in New York in any other city in the world. There's an energy and excitement to living here, and that's what makes it a great place to work in and to also live.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
With Tel Aviv's architects and designers subtly reconfiguring Israel's recent history, I left the beach and headed southeast to see, quite literally, where it all began, Jerusalem. It's home to the Bezalel Academy of Art, widely known as the birthplace of Israeli design, where young artists pull from the city's abundance of cultural and religious diversity. In Jerusalem, it's easy to get lost in a sea of languages. For one thing, it's a major religious destination. Every year, thousands of Muslims, Jews, and Christians descend on the holy city, bringing with them all manner of mother tongues. But cutting through the din of the tourists are Israel's two official languages, Arabic and Hebrew. English is actually kind of a third unofficial language. You'll see all three jammed together on street signs, in different fonts, in random orders. It's the sort of thing that tourists might not notice, but graphic designers definitely do.
I just realized that I see signage around me, and the signage in Israel is trilingual. So there is Hebrew, Arabic, and English usually on each sign. I don't speak Arabic, I was never taught Arabic, and I just realized that I look at these Arabic letters as if they were like ornaments or just decorations, like it's not any content that needs to be read. I was reading the Hebrew, obviously, I was reading the English, but the Arabic wasn't something that I needed to pay attention to. It really started to bother me, and I wanted to try and do something that will help us see both scripts, the Hebrew and the Arabic, to see them equally.
That's Liron Lavi Terkenich, a 32-year-old Israeli typeface designer. For the past 6 years, she's been designing a writing system that treats both scripts with the respect they deserve. It's called Aravrit. I met up with her on a sunny Sunday at Jerusalem's Bezalel Academy of Art, where, in addition to her own practice, she teaches the history of Israeli graphic design.
Aravrit is Arabic in Hebrew, and Ivrit is Hebrew. So Aravrit is a combining, is a mixture of both of them. Hebrew and Arabic are coming from the same resources. They come from the same areas. They both Semitic scripts. And traditionally, they are both written with the same tool, the broad nib pen. So what I wanted is to stay loyal to the nature of the script, how it's usually traditionally written, and those are calligraphic styles.
But how do you combine two separate languages, each with their own unique characters and sounds, into a unified, readable system? Liron began doing legibility studies, taking parts of Arabic letters and parts of Hebrew letters, and asking people in the street or people on the train what they recognized and what they could read.
The system is flexible, but it has its own rules. So according to legibility studies that I conducted, I discovered that you actually need the upper part of the upper half of the Arabic letters in order to be able to read them. And you need the bottom half of the Hebrew in order to read it. So basically the main characteristics of each script are in that part.
It sounds simple. The top half of the curvier Arabic letters combine with the bottom half of the blocky Hebrew letters, and readers of both languages can identify their own. But traditionally, Hebrew has 22 letters in its alphabet, and Arabic has 28, not to mention the myriad of different sound combinations in each. Liron created a clean, calligraphic typeface, where the joins between the two scripts are seamless, but it certainly wasn't a cut-and-paste sort of job.
The thing is that you actually need all the possible combinations. So every Arabic letter with every Hebrew letter, because not all the words sound the same. You basically need to write everything, so you need 638 combinations. So each letter is a hybrid letter, and it also works as a standalone character. So it also looks like it's one. It doesn't look like the combination is very stiff. It looks very natural and very organic.
For Hebrew and Arabic speakers, reading Aravrit for the first time is almost like solving a puzzle. I headed to Be'er Sheva, a city in southern Israel, to see Aravrit in action. It's currently on display at the Museum of Islamic and Near Eastern Cultures. Curator Sharon Leor Sirek included 6 Aravrit words in their current survey of Arabic calligraphy. When I arrived, a group of local schoolgirls were huddled in the corner, ignoring the room's glorious illuminated manuscripts, chatting about Aravrit.
Usually when we got kids here or other groups, I ask them what you can read. Most of them can read. They decipher it easily. Each word that you can see here in the exhibition was actually made by her as a full word. Here, Safa, it's a language, but in Arabic you can read Lura. So it's not the same letters even. It sounds different. So it's quite amazing, the meeting spot between the two languages.
Liron is still working on Aravrit, tweaking the design, asking strangers what they can read, or how they think it could be improved. The most important thing for her is that no matter which language a reader can understand, the other language is always present and never forgotten.
This is a utopian idea for everyone to be able to read and not have to think about those divisions, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I think also the utopian nature of it is it's legible. Arvrit is legible. Absolutely, you can read it. People usually ask me, what do you intend it for? And I say, the use is not on these road signs. On road signs, you know, do whatever you want, but you need these things to be part of our daily lives, kind of highlight and celebrate the fact that there are three scripts alive here in Israel. So this is maybe why it's also utopian. It doesn't need to be on street signs. There are other possibilities for this.
That was Laron Lavi Turkenich explaining her unique utopian typeface, designed specifically for Israel. As some of Israel's young designers, like Laron, grapple with the socio-political landscape of their country, others are trying to figure out a way to tap into Israel's up-and-coming design market. Omer Polak is one of those designers. The 31-year-old Bezalel graduate originally studied industrial design before he began experimenting with something a bit more delicate, florals. I headed back to the beach, specifically Tel Aviv's Florentine neighborhood, the unofficial street art capital of Israel. Here, among the industrial workshops and artist bungalows, Omer's studio combines smell, style, and craft into one tiny accessory, which has begun to make its way around the world.
I'm doing design combined with science, and I'm exploring a lot or making research about food habits and smells.
Omer is a young Israeli designer whose work is all about the sensory experience, especially the olfactory. In the past few years, he has developed an accessory that allows its wearer to carry the smell of their favorite flower around with them. It's stylish and very simple, a mini glass vase that pins to a lapel or shirt pocket. He calls it his boutique boutonniere.
Actually, it comes from a very old tradition of wearing flower on your breast pocket. People used to use many different flowers, like for special occasion. It was very common to go with a specific type of flowers for weddings and for different one for a funeral, for example. And for me, it was very interesting to understand like what is behind this tradition.
Boutonnieres were very fashionable around the turn of the 20th century. They were worn primarily by men to symbolize all manner of things, like wealth and fertility. Omer's update on the formal tradition of wearing fresh flowers is cool and casual, and unisex, equally at home on a tuxedo lapel or denim jacket. Most importantly for Omer, the refillable vase helps the flowers to stay fresh, allowing the scent to linger for longer.
The sense of smell, it's totally different from what I used to work with because I'm an industrial designer. Actually, and you know, we used to take wood, to cut it, to glue it, to connect everything to do together to make such an assembly, and we have product. And it was very interesting, and I was very curious about to work with material which is nothing. It's very elusive. It's like, you know, it's here, but it's nothing that I can cut.
Not a glassblower himself, Omer works with two different craftsmen outside of Tel Aviv to construct the boutonnieres. One provides the glass vase, each one a unique teardrop shape, no bigger than a pinky finger. A goldsmith crafts the smart brass pin, and Omer brings the two pieces together.
Actually, the first time I made it, I did it for myself, and I went with this to the opening of the exhibition that I presented this long research about the sense of smell, and the feedback I got from people was amazing. I think I didn't got it at the beginning, that it can be business, you know. I'm a designer, you just do your stuff, and I mean, if someone wants to buy, it's fine, but it's not the main goal.
Omer has turned what began as a personal experiment into a full-fledged business. His online shop sells the boutique boutonniere for 35 euros, and you can also find it in select museums and design shops around the world. One of the first places to pick up Omer's boutonniere was Saga, the place to go for local art and design in Tel Aviv and Jaffa. 5 years ago, Lior Yamin started the space to provide a platform for young Israeli designers like Omer.
When I started my business, there wasn't like a place to sell this kind of product. And now, after 5 years, there's more and more designers that knows the deals actually with prices and with customers and with trends and things that you don't learn it in school.
In his unique approach, Omer has succeeded at creating a design product that speaks both to his in-depth research and to consumers of all ages. It's something that many young Israeli designers are trying to achieve, finding the balance between design integrity and commercial success.
I think it's something very deep in the human culture to use the nature and flowers. It's like working on our old sensory experience, actually. So my interpretation for this, it's something I think very modern, something that our culture looking for, political, economical, everything. It's like people are looking for something more transparent and real. And this product, it's actually represented a little bit because it's also very simple. It's what you see, it's what you get. You get little vase, you put the water, you put whatever you want into it, and this is your design, you know. It's also changed something. It became very unique.
That was Omer Polak speaking to me from his Florentine workshop. Stepping out of Omer's studio and into the Tel Aviv sunshine, it's clear to see why, in the past 20 years, it has become the home of Israel's young design scene. There's an openness here. It's a city that's open to experimentation, unorthodoxy, and as Omer said, transparency. And while the atmosphere of Jerusalem, awash with religion and conflict, might not be a perfect place to set up a studio, its history and diversity provide endless inspiration for young designers. It's a country full of contradictions, and one that's still very much in its design infancy. As Shahar told me, he can't define Israeli design, but he knows it when he sees it. It seems that we'll just have to keep watching and see what comes next. And with that, I'll send it back over to Henry at Midori House. For Monocle, in Tel Aviv, I'm Mary Pelletier.
That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to write to me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.